and that the application will be by May 31st, will be submitted by that time. So our intent is to get it out as soon as possible into a contract basis. Thank you. Mr. Granata and Marsha Hubbard will carry this.
Thank you, Commissioner Byrne. Are there questions, Commissioner Byrne? Not. Thank you very much. Mr. Granato, you might address also, while you're talking about this, the need for haste. And it's my understanding that there was a need for expeditious consideration of this bill. You might explain it to me if you would.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The available funds to us were exhausted sometime in January, and the governor, from his contingency fund, made available $30,000, which was estimated at that time to carry us through the end of February. I believe it was yesterday the governor gave an additional $15,000 to us from his contingency fund, which is now estimated to be able to pay for service through February 25th. Because of federal regulations associated with this, we have to give 10 days notice to the clients. So we had to give that notice yesterday, and letters went out that should funds not be available, we would have to discontinue service on the 25th. The fund would be depleted, and by state statute, we could not spend money we don't have. And the governor has indicated to us that he would not be able to make additional funds available from his sources. So that's the element of timeliness that affects this supplemental.
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Granata, I apologize. I wasn't listening close enough. Why is the problem? What is the problem that we came up, let's see, $458,900 plus 30 that you spent from the governor's contingency? Why is it we came up this much short in last year's budget?
Marsha Hubbard will explain that.
The problems tend to revolve around management. Primarily, the contractor who operated the contract during FY77 was extremely slow in billing. As a consequence, when the budget was built for FY78, they had insufficient data, and they requested $100,000 less than the prior year expenditures. They asked for $100,000 decrease in their budget. Then, when the budget was passed by the FCC and went into operation, the contractor finally sent us the final billings in October. And what we had discovered was that in the last quarter, the contractor had increased his number of hours of service demonstrably, having clients on service. We then had a contract change, removed that contractor, began managing the program ourselves. In July, it wasn't until October that we knew that we had more clients on service than we actually had money budgeted for. In addition to that, when we went to the new service system, having the social workers authorizing the service, the social workers were authorizing additional clients on service. We went from 6,000 clients in July to 13,000 clients in October. Consequently, we had twice as many clients as, actually, those are numbers of hours, not people. We were providing that many more hours of service than we had money to provide.
Mr. Freeman,
what percentage of your budget goes for personal services?
In this particular budget, of the $464,000, it's a contract which is given to Warner's Bookkeeping, out of which they pay the homemaker, who is a non-state employee. Warner's Bookkeeping takes 1% for administration. But the worker, the actual homemaker, gets the rest of the money in the contract. So all of the money essentially goes to personal services, but not to state employees for personal
99%,
services.
99%, in other words, goes, if you 1%, and the rest of the other 99% would go to pay
hourly wage.
Hourly
wage homemakers and
okay,
the workers.
Let's get to the hourly wage. One of the people who works in your system told me that the problem was that you run out of money, that some kind of a shift in procedure or something, the hourly wage of the people who were doing this went from $3 and something an hour up to $5 and something an hour. Is that correct?
That's correct. However, the shift of that $2 was a shift from the administrative cost given to the prior contractor.
Well, the prior contractor was paying two homemakers in a range from approximately $3 an hour up to six something an hour. In addition, the previous contractor had full-time salaried people who were getting considerably more than that. There was little rhyme to reason as to how they were paying, but most of the people in rural Alaska were getting paid at the $3 level. When we entered into this contract, in order to try to bring some equity to it, we turned to the state salary schedule and we looked at jobs there. And we settled on range 5 classification, which generally is still for jobs that are probably lower in responsibility. And we applied the hourly wage at step A, range 5, to make more equitable the hourly rate. So 517 is the top, which affects Anchorage, Ketchikan, Juneau, and then the adjustment for Bethel, Nome, and other areas is the same adjustment that is provided in state salary. Even though these are not state employees, we felt that adjustment made sense in terms of the cost of living.
Mr. Freeman.
In other words, there is some validity in then to the claim that one of the reasons you're having problems is the fact that you raised the wages. That would be a fair statement, right?
Had we not raised the wages, the money could have gone to service, but we didn't know that the service was already being delivered. The money in the prior year had gone to administrative costs. We wiped it away from the administrative costs and gave it to the end worker.
The overall unit rate of service this year, including administrative costs, is lower than the overall unit rate, including administrative costs, of the previous year. So for every unit of service delivered this year, the cost of payments to the homemaker plus the administrative overhead that's charged against this line item is lower than what it was last year.
Did you know, or did you suspect, and I could see, hardly see how you could fail it, when you increased the salaries, the wages, that there was a possibility you didn't have enough money to pay for it?
No, sir. We had been paying approximately $6.84 an hour for homemaker service to our previous contract.
No. You won't get away with that. I went and talked to some of your people who worked for you.
To our previous contractor.
To the contractor.
We were giving $6.84. That contractor was turning around and giving a $3 wage to the worker. So when we began operating the program, we determined that we'd pay a wage around 517, except for the regional distribution. So our per unit cost was $6.23. So we were paying 40, 50 cents a dollar an hour less than we had been paying before.
We shifted money, in essence, from the administrative, certain amount of the money from administrative overhead costs to give a more equitable hourly wage to the homemakers. But the overall impact of that shift actually reduced the unit cost. So we paid the contractor six-something an hour. The contractor in turn turned around and paid hourly wages in a range from $3 to $6-something.
One more question. Did you have the same problem last year on the supplemental? Did you come to this committee with a supplemental last year?
No. We lapsed about, as it ended up after the final billings came in, we lapsed somewhere around $2,000 to $3,000.
At this time last year, we were projecting a lapse of in excess of $100,000.
Would it be fair to say then that from a financial monetary standpoint, the system you used last year was a lot better than the one you're using this year?
The workers were paid less and there were fewer hours of service.
No, would be our judgment.
Mr. Mickey.
Mr. Chairman, in the interest of time, because I know that this was supposed to be a non-controversial bill, but it is a very controversial subject. My subcommittee, our staff is currently looking into this question, and we'll be dealing with it, you know, very intensely during our normal budget process. But my sort of cursory look into it, I think there are a lot of problems that I think that Oral's getting at and other ones that are raise some legitimate questions, and I'm very concerned about quite a few of them. However, I think it's my feeling, it's just my opinion, but that since Commissioner Byrne is relatively new, and since the program itself is a very good program, and I support the program, I just think there's been some management problems and some questions in it. I have no problem with the supplemental myself, but I do think that we need to raise some of these questions, and I have a lot of faith in the new commissioner, and I'm sort of reluctant to start digging into all the questions that I have in my mind because of the time problem, and also because I think there's a better forum for doing it. I just thought I'd give my
Well, if your questions relate to the supplemental, then we can hold the supplemental until those questions have been answered. If they don't, however, in the interest of expediting consideration of this.
Mr. Chairman, they relate to the program, and but I don't really think that my vote on the supplemental would change regardless of what kind of answers I got. I might want to take other kinds of action, but we have the budget as a vehicle for those kinds of conditional appropriation, so I would advocate, just from what I know, that really I don't want to hurt the program because I have some concerns over the management, and we can get into that in the full committee or through my subcommittee, however you prefer, at a later date.
Are there further questions then on this supplemental? Mr. Rhodes.
What was the date that shut this program down?
February 25th.
Well, that isn't very much time. If we're going to do something with it, I think we ought to do it.
There are a couple of other items in here. The Senate put in $2,000 for the Wrangell Social Services Office. Ernie's got the good documentation of that over there. I've seen it too. They just got social services in Wrangell, and people are working out of their house. Sort of feel like you ought to have a few bucks to get an office this year. That's what that's all about. Okay, if there are no further questions on this, I'd like to go to something else. Mr. Granato, Mr. Park, who's here tonight, made an inquiry about the social service workloads in the Anchorage and Fairbanks areas. The material that Mr. Parr elicited has been given out to the members. Essentially, I believe the memorandum that is on the top there would cover it. Is this correct to your knowledge, Mr. Granato, that it's now taken 29 days in the Anchorage and Fairbanks area?
Mr. Chairman, you're the wrong division director. Okay. This is the Division of Public Assistance and deals with eligibility workers.
Okay.
It deals
right.
with social workers.
Okay.
The 29 days is correct. We're one day away from the federal maximum. That is that if we don't get it done in 30 days, they take away the money. The federal support.
Chairman, Mr. Parr, please.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate very much the chance to have a look at this on such short notice. I had a call from Fairbanks recently, a minister up there who's a downtown church, and whose church is always helping a lot of people who are really in bad shape. And the information he had was that food stamp applications were taking 3 to 4 weeks to turn around in Fairbanks, and that the office was apparently either not aware or not telling people that there was general relief money available. And they were sending people down to the church. Well, they could help people for a few days, but they couldn't help them for 3 or 4 weeks. I did get in touch with Commissioner Byrne about this, was followed up on. I went back to Fairbanks a week ago, last Friday, and went in and talked to the people in the office, investigated this, and found that the situation wasn't quite as bad as I've been told. And there was action taken to let people know that general relief money does exist. However, the workload in the Fairbanks area had increased 50% from December to January. As we followed up on this, the information received that Anchorage is a, quote, potentially more explosive situation than Fairbanks even. It was pretty obvious to me that something needed to be done. I told Commissioner Byrne, and I volunteered this, she did not ask for this, that I would ask for a supplemental starting a bill out in the Health and Social Services Committee. And when this bill came through, 349 was supposed to be referred to my committee, but in the interest of speed, I waived that referral so it could come directly to the Finance Committee, and wrote the memo asking you if you would please consider this amendment. Now, the unemployment rate in Fairbanks is running about 20%. There's no indication that the next few months it's going to get any better. Anchorage is not hurting as badly on the unemployment situation, but they've got a caseload that's more than three times as great, and you can see the turnaround times are about the same in both places. And that, Mr. Chairman, is my reason for asking you to give this such quick consideration, which I would not normally ask you to do.
Are there questions of Mr. Farr by members of the committee? The proposal would be to add a sum of $41,354.
Steve, I just got one question.
Now,
do you still use that long, cumbersome form that you used to be battling with here a couple of years ago?
There have been some improvements, and the governor is working on something about it.
There really are several cumbersome forms, and the governor's policy committee is working on this at the present time, the Department of Policy and Planning. At the present time, they also have completed some of their original surveys, and they're now attempting a pilot program. Bethel is one of the areas they're attempting. I would hope that we'd get it down. I have trouble even filling out a little square form that gives me a decal for my car, and so I can imagine what these people have trouble with all those forms. They feel that maybe by the end of the year, of this fiscal year, we'll have something that will be much more equitable. We also hope that it'll be able to be computerized and used in different areas rather than just AFDC, just in all the public assistance programs. Incidentally, in relation to what Representative Parr is speaking about, we're not sure whether this great inflation, this influx of people that are needing assistance, is because we're in the beginning of the gas pipeline where people are anticipating to come, or if we're in the demise of the old pipeline. But there has been quite a tremendous influx, which does indicate 5 or 6 more people.
Thank you, Commissioner. Are there further questions of anybody on this bill? Okay, if you're not, I'd like to make the following motion. I'd like to move that we report out a Finance Committee substitute for Senate Bill 394. The difference between the Senate's bill and our bill would be the following. Section 3. The sum of $41,354 is appropriated to the Department of Health and Social Services to fund temporary employees for additional social services in Fairbanks and Anchorage. If I think we may be able to make a judgment in the budget process whether those employees might be made in, tent made in full-time employees, Division of Public Assistance. Division of Public Assistance, all right. And renumber section, existing section 3 of section 4. Okay, is there objection to the motion? Okay, if there's no objection, the motion carries. How many good passes do we have? Looks like the majority did pass. Thank you for, I'd like to thank Mr. Granato and Ms. Hubbard, Commissioner Burns, for testifying on the legislation. Okay. Now, House Bill 133. Matt, people in with suit. I've asked Ms. Rudd to sit with us here while we're trying to figure out what we're going to do with this thing. It's like for a work session, we've got a lot of workers. It's a pretty big gallery. There's been a request by the speaker to testify on House Bill 133, and it'll be honored immediately. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I try to keep my comments short. One of the things that prompts me to come to this meeting is that I have to admit there's a substantial interest in this legislation on the part of the district that I represent as well. I think the committee members have probably noted that in the various listings of entitlements. But generally, here's what my concerns are as a legislator. That, first of all, I think it's necessary, or at least certainly desirable, the legislature, if they're going to act at all on this question, take action this year. The main reason for that is that as time goes on, future land classifications will take place. The problems of inequity due to differences in populations are not going to get easier, they're going to get worse. It'll be probably at least twice as difficult next year and twice again as difficult the year after that to reach a legislative solution to the borough land selections, which were originally viewed as an incentive toward borough incorporation. And in thinking about it, it seems to me that one of the first things that has to be done is among the interested parties, principally the boroughs in the state, is that those people have got to stake out some sort of position and stay with it, not keep constantly changing, if we're going to be able to work out the compromises necessary to adopt the legislation. I think recently there's been a considerable amount of change going on. There's certainly been a lot occurred since last year when the bill was reported to the Finance Committee. It was assume, perhaps naively at that time, that things were in good shape. But what I'm really saying is that the minimums have to be established, and if we're going to get a bill through, I think that we have to develop a compromise that takes those things into account. I know that numerous amendments have been proposed to legislation. One of the concerns that I have for instance, with respect to one proposed amendment dealing with the mental health plans. Although the particular amendment, in my opinion, is probably a good idea, as much as I know about it. I've only looked at it. I haven't heard any testimony or arguments on it. I have to caution the committee not to load the bill down with too many diverse questions, because every time that happens, additional compromises have to be developed, and it looks like we've got a long enough list of them on this legislation right now. Specifically, in some of the arguments that have come up on the legislation so far, I don't think it was ever the intent under the Borough Incorporation Act and under the proposal that the boroughs be able to select a portion of the lands, that this was a mechanism, at least a mechanism, for directly providing that these lands move into private ownership after the boroughs have the title to these lands. I think that's a question that can be decided locally in a lot of cases. Generally, I would say that much of the state lands that exist within organized boroughs would probably be better off under local management than state management. If you adopt the position that local governments are generally responsive and responsible, and I support that contention myself. In the particular legislation, I don't know what draft the committee is working with right now. Maybe you could bring me up to date on that, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Speaker, we're working with the Community and Regional Affairs Committee substitute.
Is that the draft that includes the acreage entitlements? New set of acreage entitlements?
No, that's
bill.
No, it's the one that has the acreage entitlements.
The original CRA bill?
The okay, bill has reported out of Community and Regional Affairs.
Okay. One of the concerns that I have with the legislation as drafted, and in general with our land management statutes, is that there's a considerable amount of discretion that's granted to the commissioner or to the director of the Division of Lands under the statutes. And I think for proper management, that in a lot of cases that discretion is necessary, but there's few places, if any, in the statutes that require the decisions that are made by the director, particularly when they may affect other people's rights, to be put down in a form which allows either legislative or judicial review. And one of the things that I think that the committee should consider in this bill as well is providing some sort of mechanism at a minimum that allows a review of the decisions by the director in the case of a disagreement, say, with the municipality. If there's a written set of findings, any of the basis for review, if somebody says, well, it just seems like a good idea today, and they do it, under the law they have the authority to develop all the reasons later on, and I think they should develop them at the outset and make them clear as a matter of public policy. And then there's a basis for review by through the administrative process, through the legislative process, or through the judicial process. And that's something that doesn't really exist in our statutes today. I think it should. And I think the committee should consider it in the bill. Generally, in talking to people about the question, people from the different municipalities this year and last year, I think that for the most part, the municipalities, of course, they want the land. They don't want the payment in lieu of land. I think people here understand the reasons for that, but the main reason is it allows them a degree of control on the local level that they don't otherwise have. In any case, the settlements or payments that are proposed in the bill, of course, in terms of the real value of the property, most cases are fairly low. I think people are familiar with what has happened to land prices in the state of Alaska. I would say at a minimum right now, in the case of the Kenai Borough, where we're talking about 157,000 acres of land, or 155,000 acres of land, that minimum price that you place on something like that for market value today would be something in excess of $1,000 an acre, which equates to an actual value of over $150 million. And so I think that as near as possible in working out the compromises that may be necessary, the committee should, you know, personally, I think the committee should take that approach to see what can be done to make land available. And not have to resort to the payment section. If the committee's going to, or if the comments that, or what's wanted on the original draft of the bill, that pretty well concludes what I have to say right now, except that I want to repeat myself in that I believe that if we're going to reach a legislative settlement in the question, it's going to be much more difficult next year than it is right now, because these problems are not going to become simpler, they're going to become more complicated. Less land will be available, population differences will increase, pressures will increase. And so I would urge the committee to try to develop the necessary compromises to make the program possible. And I'd be glad to try to answer any questions on either the philosophy or the specifics. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Freeman.
Questions on practice and philosophy, if I may, Mr. Chair. Mr. Speaker, do you know on what the 10% entitlement for the Kenai Borough would have been, notwithstanding this bill?
Probably.
The question is, are they getting more or less than the 10%?
I think they're getting the same.
Getting the same.
That's the basis for the figure of the Kenai entitlement. And in the case of that acreage figure, regardless of whether the committee may find it necessary to adjust other acreages up or down, in discussions with people, including the borough mayor and the borough assembly there, that's what they figure they're entitled to, and personally I agree with them. And if there's, you know, necessary compromises result in reductions of entitlements, it probably should be done on a pro rata basis, but they aren't looking for any more than that.
In your honest opinion, do you, I think I know the answer already. You said the borough would, and I think this would apply to all of them, would much rather have the land than the money. Isn't the reason for that the fact that they expect to, you know, what they're really interested in the land more than anything else is revenue, something to produce revenue, and as long as they hold on to it and lease it or whatever they want to do with it, it'll be something that produces revenue forever, and that the tendency on the part of the municipal governments will not be to let that land get out into private ownership.
Well, the municipal governments with which I'm familiar are controlled by elected councils and assemblies. And I think in the case, for instance, the Kenai Borough, a very strong interest in transferring a portion of that in private ownership and collecting the cash for it, of course. But I think there's a lot of cases where valid public purposes can be identified for various tracts of land, and any borough would be prudent to retain those. In terms of trying to retain them in perpetuity as an income-producing mechanism, I think that that's an option that, you know, the borough certainly would have under the Act. I think it is an option, though, that would be responsive to what the people in the local communities wanted to see happen. Maybe I'm wrong, but
right now, one of the main problems that municipalities face in disposing of their land, particularly the boroughs, the lands that they do have, is that there's certainly no guarantee that they're going to get any more. So if the little bit that they have right now is going to be all of it, then that requires one management approach. They're going to get something like the original entitlement envisioned under the Borough Incorporation Act, then I think that it would lead to a different strategy in management.
Mr. Speaker, if you, you know, I can see why the problem doesn't look the same to you in a borough that's, you know, just the normal 10% entitlement is 155,000 acres. Because if you gave the borough the 155,000 acres tomorrow, apparently there's still another 90% that is unappropriated, unreserved, that belongs to the state. That the state, if the legislature or whatever weapon can be used to force the state to turn loose a few acres of land, can find its way into private ownership. You know, that's not a big problem to you, but what if you lived in a community where there was only 10,000 acres available, and this bill would propose to give all 10,000 of that to the municipality and leave nothing for, in other words, as I've said earlier, all you're doing is transferring from one landlord to another, and the people are still not going to be able to get their hands on the land. Would you think you'd feel the same about it as you do where you have, where just a mere 10% of land represents 155,000 acres?
Mr. Chairman? Probably not, but I think that if a demand exists within the community for additional private land, that, and if I were a member of that particular borough, I'd probably petition the assembly to set up a disposal program, some sort of home site act or something.
Mr. Speaker, I know you spent some time in municipal government, and you know that's they're not going to. I can think of 1,000 arguments that I would use right quick. Number one, you don't let these people have this land too cheap. You lessen the assessed valuation of the other land, therefore you'd be doing yourself in. There's all kinds of an argument that I can think that a municipal government's going to use to counteract that and justify not doing that. I know it's exactly the same arguments that I would have used when I was in municipal government. And I just don't, you know, I have the fear, again, as I said before, that where there is an actual shortage of land, that we're actually just, you know, exchanging one money-hungry landlord for another one. And the people are not going to benefit. And maybe the landlord will be a little closer to the people, but he'll be nonetheless hungry. And besides that, he's in a position that the state legislators can't reach him. And I hate to go back to start over in municipal government to work on the problem.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Speaker.
Well, you know, as I gather, of course, this really is this conversation, or line of questions revolving around the limited amount of land that's available in Southeast Alaska. And, you know, I think it's perfectly possible through separate legislation to establish state policy for the 400,000 acres of forest selections in Southeast Alaska. The legislature generally has neither reviewed nor established state selection policy for state lands, except in a very peremptory fashion in the early days. And I think that's a matter that definitely needs attention. But I think that that could be done outside the questions of House Bill 133. Basically, what I'm saying, Mr. Chairman, is that I think that the legislature, as a matter of law, can require that a certain amount or a certain percentage of the state selectable lands be made available for private ownership in Southeast Alaska.
do that as a matter of law, I believe.
Mr. Meekins.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I do have a couple of questions for Hugh and then some other things I want to cover if I can. Hugh, I understand what you're talking about. You say we don't want to rock this boat too much in a sense and people should stick to their position. But you know, I've been very critical up to this point. I'm trying to become more positive, get some suggestions. We went through the same sort of song and dance last year when the bill came in and we all reacted to it because 5% of the population was getting 50% of the land in the case of Mat-Su, and in the case of Anchorage, 50% of the population was getting 2.8% of the land distributed. And that's just based on population. I know that size is a consideration and everything too, but it really seemed inequitable, and I think it still is, and it really, I feel, you know, badly to have to vote for a bill that is so defective, even though I understand some of the legal problems and this is a settlement of a, you know, 14-year-old, 13-year-old claim or whatever. And some of the things I think that have improved the bill are these possibility of mental health lands, and maybe, we've looked into this today a little bit, school lands, especially in the Anchorage area, would help to alleviate some of the real inequities in this, and also prevent us from having to tap the treasury in some cases. We wouldn't have to have any new payments. And I'm sort of hoping that pans out. I think it's sort of a long shot because we've got to go through the mental health boards and the school boards, and even if we can legally do it, and I'm not sure we can legally do it, but you know, if it does pan out, it seems to me like it's really you'd be pretty lucky and it'd be a good thing to incorporate. You're not opposed to that if it works out, are you?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Speaker?
No, basically what I'm, you know, I think that changes of position in terms of the direction of the bill and the amounts of what the entitlement should be have already occurred in a lot of cases mm-hmm. since last year. And what I'm saying really right now is that sooner or later those changes have to stop. For instance, we take entitlement for Anchorage is set out in House Committee Substitute for House Bill 133 by the CNRA Committee as 20,865 acres in one work draft of legislation that I've seen that figure would go to 45,000 acres. Well, maybe that's all right, but what I am saying is that sooner or later we have to come to an agreement as to what is a rational and reasonable figure, something that people feel comfortable with. And it can't keep on changing and changing and changing as a bill goes through committee or as it stays in committee, because at that point, if that happens, it's impossible to work out the necessary compromise. With regards to your question on the, you know, the mental health lands, as I said, I think the specific amendment which I saw is probably a good idea, and I understand its impact on the legislation, what it's designed to do. I'm only saying that the committee should be cautious in terms of how much additional stuff they include in this bill, because every time you do that, a whole new set of compromises is necessary. And I think this bill is gasping for air right now.
Mr. Chairman, I remember what your comments were in terms of our options, and I understand exactly what Hugh just said in terms of this bill. As people bail out and change their position, this bill becomes more and more decrepit, and we need to pass it this year. And I believe that very, very strongly. I was a member of the subcommittee that, you know, we asked to, in fact, I was one of the people that asked to hold this over so we could work on in the interim, and then I didn't have a chance during the interim due to, it's my fault, but because I was too busy with other matters to really concentrate on this bill, and consequently it comes up before us again, and I'm still just in the same position, being very critical and not having a lot of positive things to contribute. But I did spend about 3.5 hours on it today, and I think I have a, you know, there is a way to rationalize this whole process here. One of the things that I've been reacting to very strongly is that it's so chaotic. It's completely, it's not based on any kind of workable philosophy. The original idea, just, you know, based on 10% of the vacant land, didn't really make a lot of sense in terms of being rational as some sort of formula. And then it got worse as we picked certain things and made parks out of them, and there's other kinds of entitlements and classifications, so that now it has absolutely nothing to do with any kind of rational formula that one would make based on any kind of procedure. So I think there's a way, though, Mr. Chairman, and I know everyone's very reluctant to open up this bill because it is such a Pandora's box to, and that they think everything will break apart and that all the people that have now come together and agreed will jump off and it'll just be terrible. But I do think that there is a way to rationalize this, and we just played around with it today and had a three-factor formula, one of the factors being the old law, which I feel will reduce a lot of the inequities, will make it based on something reasonable and rational and take a lot of the chaos out of this thing, and won't change the numbers all that much for the people then who are very much wanting this legislation, that being Fairbanks, Mat-Su, and Kenai, the ones that are really making out well on it. So, you know, I think we need to incorporate those other concepts and other amendments. So I would hope that the committee would see fit to work on this, to actually, you know, do some intense work on it. I think we can get it out in a week or 10 days. I really do. And I'd go through my suggestions if anyone was interested.
Well, that was the purpose of the meeting tonight. I'd like to ask if anybody has any further questions of Mr. Malone or whether he has some further to set for the committee, because what I'd like to do is end the formal session and start the work session, and we don't have to do all this formal stuff.
Is he going to join us in the, Mr. Chairman, is he going to join us in the informal session here, work session? Because I have a couple questions that I'd like to ask.
Mr. Chairman, one of the reasons I'm here is to protect the interests of my district in response to Red's comment. The other thing, though, in terms of final comment in your formal session, Mr. Chairman, is that, you know, the legislature, in regards to this matter, they can do anything that's reachable by law. And the policies, for the most part, are based on the laws that the legislature passes. So that, you know, I think that this is a question where, in order to reach any sort of solution at all, the legislature is going to have to dictate the policy. And within that, they're going to have to work out the necessary compromises. But I think that since the situation has come up since the original provisions were put into the Borough Act, the questions are only going to be settled in the legislature.
Mr. Nugget,
what do you mean by the original Borough Act?
Well, the idea of being able to select 10% of the state land as vacant and unappropriated.
That was the original Borough Act. But the old boroughs were organized by their own action. The state didn't take part.
Well, it depends on the borough you're talking about.
I'm just beating you into a question. Why hasn't the state exercised the mandatory Borough Act? Can they tell me that?
No, guys.
Okay, that's a pretty good reason. But going farther back than that, isn't you know, what if it goes back to the Constitution, that the legislature or the administration, somebody had to draw the borough line. Isn't that right? Nobody did it.
Well, the Constitution just says it's provided by law and it's set up the system, but we can actually draw the line.
One way or another, those lines have to be established, but what's going to happen to the unorganized area of the state?
Let me call the formal session of this thing, you know, to a halt, and then we're going to start in the work session. I think we've reached a point where we can do that.